Thinking Fellows listeners. This is your host, Caleb Keith, and I'm with my father, Dr. Scott Keith. And, you know, it's almost 7 years, so we get a little slack on this one. We're going to post our first correction ever. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't been wrong in those 7 years about minutia, but I think this time actually warranted the first correction. So, Dad, do you want to make your correction?
Yeah, so what happened is in the last two episodes of the Chronicles of Narnia series, in The Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle, I mentioned many times that I had been reading C.S. Lewis's Beyond Personality, and mentioned that as sort of his lectures on medievalism that he gave. That, in fact, is a mistake. The book that I should have been referring to is The Discarded Image. So every time during the next two shows you hear Beyond Personality, substitute in your mind The Discarded Image. What had happened was over the weekend I read Beyond Personality, started on The Discarded Image on Monday, was really influenced by The Discarded Image. I really like it. It really helped me clarify some things in Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle, but had Beyond Personality on the brain. Mm-hmm. So the problem here is in this series getting me too excited about Lewis, and in the last 3 weeks I've read, like,
just reading a lot and Abolition of mixing
Man,
the
Beyond
titles
Personality,
up.
Surprised by Joy, Discarded
so,
Image.
So really, just as a final, the book, the only book outside of Chronicles of Narnia really being referenced in the next two episodes
is The Discarded Image.
Is The Discarded Image. So I'll try to type out something similar in the show notes for those who,
I apologize for my mistake.
Apologize there. Somebody may notice, but I'm just going to post this at the beginning of both episodes. So following this message right now, you're going to hear our full episode. We'll catch you next time. Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco, as we continue to read through the Chronicles of Narnia. This show is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our episodes there. You can also go to 1517.org's homepage to see all of the projects at 1517, which includes a daily blog, sermon prep help. We also have video and conferencing. You can find all of that at 1517.org. If you would like to join us for our next conference that will be happening in Northwest Arkansas, you can go to 1517.org/events to see the list of events there. I will put a link to that event in Arkansas. That is a Here We Still Stand regional event. And will all three of us be there, or just you and me, Dad? I don't know. Adam, are you coming to that?
When is it again?
April something.
Yeah, I'd like to come.
All right. So maybe all three of us will be there.
Road trip.
Road trip. And
Actually, Joy and I are driving out to that.
Oh, that'd be cool. Quite the drive from California to Arkansas.
Really? Bring in the trailer.
Jeez. Oh, nice. Nice.
So, yeah. And again, I'll put a link in the show notes to that event. And hopefully we will see you there. So, today we are going to talk about The Magician's Nephew. And, you know, this is, for a lot of people, the... If you had a new set and you sort of just read them in order, I don't know when. Do you guys know when they made this change to the chronological order versus the order written?
I have no idea. I remember being in a Barnes & Noble about 8 years ago, maybe, and just kind of...
I think it's longer than that,
flipping
though.
My finger along and coming across Chronicles of Narnia and looking at it going, what's going on?
I think it was within Lewis's lifetime.
Okay. I was going to say, it feels like my whole life.
His publisher asked him, what should the proper order be? And he laid out the sort of the one that we're,
so
that we're not
actually,
following.
Now that you say that, didn't we talk a couple episodes about the letter where he,
so... Yeah, I just didn't know if they actually made the sales change, how soon. But
sorry, that was my coffee cup.
Yeah. I was like, who the?
Scratching records.
Is it just coffee?
It is just
so
coffee.
It would probably be safe to assume that for a lot of people, this is the first book they ever read. the magician's nephew. And unless, you know, somebody in their life had the secret knowledge that it really wasn't book one. And
I still contend that most people have probably only read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Okay. That's
personally, but
yeah, I think you're right. And it, Scott, you would know this, I'm assuming. Was the book written not only because, but in part because somebody asked Lewis where the light pole came from?
Oh, the magician's nephew.
Maybe I read that somewhere.
Yeah, I've heard that as a quasi apocryphal story. I mean, I'm not sure. I've heard that.
Okay.
I think once he started on the path to, we'd say in modern day terms, expanding the universe, as you would, mm-hmm. That it was inevitable that he was going to have to do creation and the last days.
So that, yeah, because
even if he hadn't originally planned to, but I do like, I love the lamppost. And I love that Uncle Ann, you know, that everybody starts thinking, what could we bury in the ground there and mine and have for our own ships and technology and steam engines and gold? And
yeah, I feel like I should try to, because I think there are some letters explaining some of his process or his thoughts as he was going through Narnia. And it would be interesting to just either confirm or deny some of the ideas I've had. And by Magician's Nephew, it really felt in this book like he had hit a stride, that some of the, I would say some of the, like the devices he had put in earlier had served their purpose to the point where he could sort of rewrite and rework portions of the world to expand it in a more cohesive way. And it kind of feels like I don't know if he knew he was going to do only seven by this point, but then once we get to the last battle, which is our next episode, it felt like he wrote it to stop himself from expanding.
Yeah.
Because he's made it now so that every known human who's interacted with Narnia is in the stage, actually by Magician's Nephew, that is true. You've had sort of now the complete list of people who have, you know, made it into Narnia. Nobody's added in the last battle.
Yeah, Professor Kirk has explained.
In this, and Polly. Mm-hmm. And then in the last battle, it makes it so that he can't write any more of these in-between stories, or if he does, he couldn't add new characters, or you would be wondering or asking where they are in the last battle. So it almost seems like a you have to stop kind of thing, or maybe he wanted to. I don't know, but it's interesting to me because it really does feel like the world begins to make the most sense in light of the magician's nephew, that then it comes to a close after the next book he pens.
Magician's Nephew wraps up a lot, like you're saying, which is why I think it's an interesting choice as the first book. And I guess, I mean, who am I to disagree with Lewis himself on this? But at the same time, if you read Magician's Nephew first, you know what? That has got to lessen some of the excitement of meeting Aslan in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like it does.
It certainly does, I think, theologically.
Yeah.
Right? I think, Scott, you made the point when we first started on this series, what, 5 weeks ago now? Is that right,
Caleb? Yeah.
Or I guess so. Since
or, yeah, 6 weeks.
Or 6 weeks ago. And you, Scott, you talked about how it kind of parallels the way we do theology. You know, you start from Christ rather than creation.
At least the way we do evangelism and apologetics, for sure, which is the way we do theology.
Yeah.
Yeah. Start at Christ and move from there. So I just think...
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's like if you learn about Aslan, you want to know more, right?
Yeah, that's so what I'm saying.
Your understanding of Narnia and all the other worlds, I guess, Charn and other places, it keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
It's would you guys use the term earlier, universe building or something like that? So, or universe expanding?
Universe, that's what they use with like the Marvel stuff and whatnot. That's why I use it.
Yeah, most of it That's, I would say, the common label. They'll even talk about, like, the Lord of the Rings universe, or you name a thing, it's got a universe, especially if it's not claiming to take place on Earth. So if you have, like, a one-off novel that's, say, fiction about World War II, they're not going to talk about, like, universe building as much as you are when you're creating fantasy worlds.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Plot expansion, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the other.
Yeah. So, but these don't have a lot of tie to this. Though there are some interesting interactions with human history. So, I think Lewis really does allude to the power of the atomic bomb.
He really does, yeah.
Well, and sort of his fear and apprehension and maybe personal feelings about atomic warfare.
About a technology that could end all human life.
Yeah.
You know, the word, what's the word? Is it the despised word?
The deplorable word.
Deplorable word.
The deplorable word.
Yeah, it's just, you can't help but draw the connection there between things going on in Lewis's own time. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say that this story, more than the others, is Lewis's story. Diggory's mother is sick in this. His life is not great. I mean, the beginning of the book kind of has to do, even as they're sort of exploring in the attic spaces between what I assume are row houses, mm-hmm. in London. And if you've ever stayed even in one of those, like, London hotels, it obviously used to be kind of a bigger a house, like a four-story house in London, and they're actually all connected. You know, you can kind of imagine, mm-hmm. where they're crawling, you know, and trying to take as they're taking these steps, have we gone far enough? And oops, we're still in Diggory's house, and we're now in Uncle Andrew's study. But that his mom is sick, and that how much this is messing with Diggory's world is very much Lewis. I mean, again, surprised by joy. Even towards the end, when he really wants to get one of these apples to bring home to his mom, to heal his mom, you know, in Surprised by Joy, Lewis sort of makes the point that unless the idea of miracles when he was a kid could have applied directly to him and could have done something about his mother's death. After that, nothing mattered to him, mm-hmm. anymore, until he got to be an older man and was converted. But you see this Lewis writing that same struggle into the character of Diggory, which is Professor Kirk. And then I think obviously in the rest of the books, if you were to say, you know, who's the most like Lewis in this, it's Professor Kirk. So it's the Diggory character for sure. And I really like that. I see a lot of parallels in this too to Surprised by Joy, because both Diggory and Polly, they kind of go into this as materialists. And the idea of Uncle Andrew's magic, Uncle Andrew has to explain it to him, the fact that there is this thing called magic. I know you've been taught out of this in schools. There is this thing called magic. It really does work. And when they do it, you know, it's a very, it would be to anybody, of course, but it's a very surprising event. Diggory's conversion, as it were, to the faith of Aslan, is one that is a longer one than in some of the other stories. He's very reverent to him, but the fact that
it is long, the interaction with Aslan is longer.
The purpose that Aslan serves, essentially as the you know, the son of the Emperor Beyond Sea, takes longer to get to for Diggory here, and I like that.
Yeah, this book is often characterized, and we even did it earlier as this was going off my memory before I reread it, but as the creation story, which is certainly true, but I think it's more than the creation story. More time is actually spent on the introduction of evil to the world. This is actually more of a story of how could a good world have evil introduced into it, and not by the person who's creating it. Because
you get introduced to the supernatural, you get introduced to the idea of other worlds, you get introduced to the idea of pure evil.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite parts about the book is after Aslan, and the part of the creation story that's so wonderful is the fact that Aslan sings Narnia into existence. That's, I mean, talk about if they ever do a movie, I'd love to see that. You know, just singing Narnia into existence. That's always striking to me.
Yeah, there are great things about it, like the chicken and the egg thing. Yes. You know, the question.
Yeah.
So, when people ask this, they're like, how could a tree carbon date to, 10 million years old?
He deals
and stuff.
With that a little
oh,
bit.
Oh, I'm just always like, God can make a tree whatever age he wants. Well, Lewis's version of this is, a sapling comes out of the ground, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing while Aslan's walking, because the song of creation, the song of life, is still hanging in the air.
So even references similar to what they do in the next one, The Last Battle, it could have been a minute, it could have been a day, it could have been 100 years. They don't know, because, of course, time works differently in Narnia, right? And so they don't know. Those are always weird questions. How could this be? I always think, are you actually inquiring whether or not
question.
I could postulate a circumstance under which that could be, because I could.
Although, Aslan, funny enough, does assign time to the thing. He actually, at the point, like when he sends Didgeridoo out for the apples,
he's talking about hours. Yeah, and that's one of the things I love.
He's like, this world is only but 5 hours old.
Yeah, I mean, actually mentions, I think, 3 different hours.
Yeah,
and evil's already entered it.
Yeah, and then 2 hours later, he goes, and this
7 hours,
7 hours, yeah. And this is, yeah,
and evil's already here. Anyway, very good.
Did you Scott, we've talked about Michael Ward's book, where he suggests that the Chronicles of Narnia are sort of built off of medieval cosmology and so on. Is there a sort of like so I did a little back checking on when the multiverse theory or multiple worlds hypothesis kind of became a thing.
Mm. Yeah.
And I mean, there's a little bit of that in here, right?
There is, yeah.
Kind of, sort of.
Kind of way, but there is, yeah.
Yeah. Then I read something that said that even, and I guess I should have known this since I taught medieval history for years, that even in the Middle Ages, folks were thinking about multiple worlds,
realms
that might exist alongside
I think
ours.
Realms, yeah, it would be.
Yeah. I think the difference between sort of, at least the way, I'm not saying that I know anything about the physics of multiverse, but the way it's represented in,
guess what, nobody does.
Yeah,
we have no evidence for it. Only mathematical speculation.
I'm glad you said that.
Sorry.
No, I'm glad you said that. The thing is, she's got her. The thing is that. The way that multiverses are represented in sort of modern movies, say like the Avengers saga, is that every multiverse is a variant of a different decision made in a timeline. And so in that way, each different decision literally branches off and creates another universe that's in many ways very similar to the universe you're in, except for that one decision.
Every human choice can create a new
cataclysmic
world.
Change, and then those are endless. I don't think that's what he's doing here. I actually think he's doing more realm stuff. Like, there's actually
More medieval.
I think
different creatures, different people
in a different place.
In a different place, the space and the mechanics of this are maybe overlapping. Right. This is why Narnia in our world might. It's alluded to occupy the same space.
Yes.
Uncle Andrew says this, but they're, it's not like this is just an alternate Earth where a different decision was made.
Yes.
It's actually a different realm.
The latter you're talking about, the Avengers sort of multiple worlds sort of thing, is more of the philosopher's possible worlds theory, mm-hmm. The best of all, or what are the possible worlds out there? And it's interesting there. I mean, this is getting way off track, but they all assume that there are certain laws that hold in all these different universes, whereas in Lewis's, these worlds, there's different rules.
Yeah, there's complete
things yeah, are very different.
Things aren't the same, and I like that better. So, by the way, on the medieval, so the Michael Ward book, the Planet Narnia book, I haven't finished that yet because through reading the Narnia books, Adam's got me sending down different Lewis rabbit holes. So, but one of them is the Beyond Personality.
I'm doing that so you can report back to me so I don't have to read them.
Well, I'm almost done with Beyond Personality, and there's a couple of things that just will blow your mind about that book. First of all, I think it's a series, it's a reprint of a series of four lectures, maybe. Somebody's going to write in that I'm wrong, and it's three or five or whatever.
But, doesn't matter.
It's shocking how much Lewis knows about the medieval period. I mean, just absolutely shocking. And
isn't that funny when somebody doesn't spend a lot of, so he's, you know, famous in the public eye for something totally outside of his academic expertise. So then when you're actually awakened to that he was knowledgeable on his in his academic field as well, it's kind of like, it's like mind-blowing that really what we have here is an expert on, you know, medieval to Renaissance Reformation history.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is that when I got about halfway through Planet Narnia, and I wasn't enjoying it as much as I thought I was going to. And I think that's because I didn't actually realize how much of a medievalist Lewis really was until I started reading Beyond Personality and just what he quotes off the top of it. Well, I'm sure he researched it to write the lectures, but it just is amazing. I mean, he just knows more than I've ever even considered to learn about medievalism. And I do think there's a connection here. I do think that I don't know that point for point, Michael Ward is right. He probably is. I don't know that he is, but I do know that after sort of getting through most of Beyond Personality, Lewis is incorporating a lot of that world, quote unquote, worldview into Narnia. And into the idea of realms, the idea of different worlds, the idea of, I mean, Lewis in Beyond Personality even goes into sort of like astrological signs and how the church wasn't opposed to him and why the church wasn't opposed to him and what it did mean and what they were opposed to and what they weren't opposed to and all that. And in here, how like even the stars are people in Narnia, you know, he talks about how the stars are people in the medieval period. And it's just, so there is a lot of it in there for sure.
Yeah. And I think this is a pedantry here, but would Lewis call it medieval? You know, his lecture when he takes the chair at down at Cambridge, you know, what is it? The inaugural lecture, he divides the world. He makes a point that, that position of medieval and Renaissance literature goes a long way to dispelling the distinction between the medieval and the modern.
He doesn't like and he doesn't like the Dark Ages label.
I think this, so some of the rabbit holes I've chased, because you're chasing other ones for me, Scott, is that, you know, I think they use the term pre-modern. The point is always made, and I don't know if Lewis was really conscious of this, but that Lewis was sort of like right in the middle of modernity, and post-modernism is starting to emerge.
Still as he's fighting modernism.
which is a critique of modernism, but Lewis didn't go with post-modernism because he knew that was just as problematic. And Lewis was decidedly a pre-modern man.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I've been thinking for myself, like, how can I be like that?
It's amazing. I mean, parts of it are amazing. Parts of Beyond Personality are just shockingly good. It'd be difficult to do shows on them because just nobody's going to read that book to follow up with us. But there's parts of it that are just shockingly good. And I think the correlations to here, I mean, I'd say more so in Magician's Nephew than in any of the other books. Magician's Nephew really is, as far as I've kind of gotten through it so far, a setup that could have been from the ideas in Beyond Personality. It just is. So even the idea of creation and how it comes into existence, and Caleb and I were talking before the show that one of the things he does here in Magician's Nephew is kind of like you know, we get in Genesis through the inspiration of God of, you know, an explanation of one part of creation, but really not an explanation for how the other parts came into existence.
We have an isolated view of Eden and the events happening in Eden, but outside of that border, the events are, or the, you know, the comings about who's there, what's there, what's going on there, isn't really revealed to us. And part of that has to do with that the story of all of Scripture is about particular people that God has chosen to carry out and bring about this promise. And you get a sense of that in Magician's Nephew as well, that this selecting by God for particular people that are going to be carrying out this promise, this redemption, and going to have to deal especially with this evil which has entered the world. And, you know, he selects certain beasts to talk and in the book, right? And he actually says that to them, some of you I have chosen, others I haven't, right? He talks about the animals he's chosen to speak and then the ones that he didn't pull out of the common beasts.
Yeah, he puts his nose to them and essentially breathes on them and they get a soul.
And then, you know, the first order of business, again, he says, this world is not yet five hours old and, you know, evil has already come into it. And so he brings a council of, he makes another choice out of these animals he's already chosen to come explain to this council what role beasts and men are going to play in undoing this introduction of evil to Narnia, so staving off and undoing. And so there really becomes a purpose for this choosing, which is the undoing of this introduction of evil, which he saw as he was singing, you know, the creation in. It helps if you're looking for an image of questions like, how is evil introduced into our world if it's not part of the God speaking creation into existence type of thing? And when you read broadly in the Old Testament and you begin to get a picture of Satan and the fallen angels and all of this, and you are in, and you go back to Genesis and you see the creation narrative and the snake is there already, right? And things like that. You get an idea that this is kind of a helpful picture to see that an invasive force from another world has fallen into our creation and, you know, fallen like lightning from the sky, as it's said, right? And that brings evil, you know, into the realm, into the world.
And now it's there.
And now he has a plan for dealing with it that has to do with these people that he's
It has to be dealt with.
Yeah. Chosen, and it now has to be dealt with.
So we didn't do a recap. Should we do a recap of it? We didn't go. Do we need to? We don't have to.
You can do a little bit of one. I mean,
I like when Scott does them. I don't think you're doing it with any notes, are you? It's just sort of in your head. It's like you have a Narnian worldview.
A Narnian worldview. Oh, no.
So this one is kind of fun. I think it's actually got a rather abrupt start to it. So there are two characters that you get to know here. Diggory Kirk, who is Professor Kirk, and Polly Plummer, who is essentially, as he's staying in the house of his aunt and uncle in London, is his next door neighbor while he's there, right? His mom is sick and staying in this house, and his dad is some sort of official that's been shipped off to India to go do work in India.
I think it is funny. He can only think of children in even pairs. Yeah. So it's obvious that he had, you know, one sibling himself. Children come in pairs.
They come in twos.
I think by the time he's not writing about the Pevensey children anymore, too, it's obviously intentional that it's always a boy and a girl, you know. I think part of that is that he knows he's writing for children, and if you write a children's story, it's always about the adventures that children playing together start, right, each book. And then after that, he knows that if little girls are going to read this, there's got to be a little girl in the book. And if boys are going to read this, there's got to be a boy in the book.
But there's got to be some, like, girl-boy conflict.
And there has to be the tension based on the fact that boys want to do this kind of thing and girls want to do this kind of thing.
You don't know direction. You're too impulsive, you know, all this girl-boy stuff.
And that might then write in you know, people go, and there's his sexism, except that that really is part of writing a hook that make little girls and little boys interested in reading about things.
You could call it sexism or just kind of knowing kids.
Yeah.
A little bit. Although it is in Beyond Personality where you hear Lewis say that he does not especially enjoy the company of young children. I myself do not especially enjoy the company of young children. Okay. So you got Diggory and Polly, right? And they're staying in the house of Uncle Andrew and Aunt Letty in London, and his mom is sick. His dad's off in India. Next door neighbor is Polly, right? So right off the bat, you get this interaction between Diggory and Polly, and you know, he doesn't know what to do for fun in London, and what she does for fun essentially is goes up into the attics and crawls between the houses to do, I don't know, weird spying stuff or something like
strange.
That. And at one point when they're doing this, kind of right off the bat, they end up in the study of his Uncle Andrew, who's just a real quirky kind of guy. And what they find out up there is that Andrew is doing magic up there. And he... he believes he's descended from sorcerers and that he's got some sort of inherent ability to do this. Queen Jadis quickly disabuses him of that idea once they meet. But basically what he's gotten a hold of are some magic compounds and makes two kinds of rings out of them, a gold ring and a green ring. One to get you to a new place and a new world, and one to bring you back from that world. Uncle Andrew has tried to use these, but he's not been brave enough himself to use them, so he's put it on a
guinea pig.
Guinea pig, and sent a guinea pig off to God knows where. And he basically tricks the children in.
He uses them as guinea pigs,
and tricks Polly. Really tricks, doesn't like trick her into doing it, but tricks her and makes her sort of touch the ring, and it. It takes her off into God knows where. And Diggory, being the honorable young British gentleman that he is not going to leave his friend Polly in this sort of state. And so he says, well, Uncle Andrew, you forced me into it. I guess I have to go get her. And so he sort of takes the rings himself, and he goes to find her, and where they end up is in this place called the Wood Between the Worlds. They're basically in a wood. They kind of emerge out of a pond into this wood, and in this wood there are other ponds, and each pond is an entrance to another world. Fast forwarding a little bit, they go into one of the ponds, and that pond puts them in a world called Charn. Charn is a destroyed world. There's nothing living in Charn. It's all ruins. But they enter into a room where there are... Lewis writes it as sort of analogous to a wax museum. Right? Yep. That there are figures there that are memorial figures of people in the past. There's a bell on a table... that's got some message on it about great magic if you ring the bell. And Polly's like, for God's sakes, whatever you do, don't ring the bell. And Diggory's like, I can't do anything but ring the bell. I was picturing Emerson and Esther here.
Oh, my gosh.
Esther going, don't ring the bell. And Emerson going, if I take one more breath, I must ring the bell. And so Diggory rings the bell.
And the bell has a lie written on it.
Yeah, it has
a lie. And you don't actually know that that's a lie until Aslan sort of draws, asks Diggory if it was a lie or not. And Diggory says, yes, it was a lie. So, because the bell tells you that if you don't ring it, you will be haunted forever with the thought of what would have happened if you rang it.
If you didn't, yeah. Mm-hmm. So much like the lie the serpent told Eve, yeah. So he rings it, and it basically wakes up Jadis, who we've already met in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Unfortunately, now I think I have to agree with you.
Is the Witch in the Silver Chair.
Is the Witch in the Silver Chair. Yeah. Although, so, I don't think Lewis knew that when he wrote it.
So
I want to point
out. Since you disagreed with me, I've done some sort of like commentary reading on it, and there's just not agreement on it. It's just hotly debated topic.
I think Lewis didn't know at the time of the Silver Chair. That he was going to write Jadis as the last living of her race. So I think that's part of the problem.
Right.
I think what
She can't be a kind like Jadis because there are normal kinds like Jadis.
Yeah, we have a I think he just hadn't decided a lot of things is what's coming to me, and he sort of was going along as he went.
Right. So she wakes up and, you know, she won't pay. I think one of the interesting things is she doesn't really pay attention to Polly at all. She looks right at Diggory and talks to him. But eventually she scares Everlyn Daylights out of both of them. And they're like, well, let's get out of Charn. This is where they discover the idea that she is the one that in her world during a war with her sister that she was losing used the deplorable world word and destroyed everything on Charn, which is why it's the whole world is a ruin. They say, let's get out of here. They use the rings to go back to the wood between the world. But what you found out from Polly comes true here with Jadis too, that you don't actually have to be yourself in possession of one of the rings or have the ring on your finger. You just have to touch the ring and or touch somebody who is touching the ring. And that's what the witch does. I think she grabs Polly's hair, actually. And she ends up through the pool in the wood between the world. Fast forward a little bit. She's very powerless in the wood between the worlds. And they say, ha, we got you. We're going to jump back to London. And so they sort of jump in the pond, head back to London. And
well, Diggory feels bad for her.
Diggory feels bad for her.
Because they like beat her. So she's so strong she could snap Polly's arm is what Polly feels. And then they get to this wood between the worlds and like they notice she's weak and so they beat the crap out of her and they like push her back and beat her down and she's like, no, I'm dying. And as they're about to leave, Diggory goes, we can't just leave this woman we beat up in the woods here.
I love later in the book when Polly's like, and I'm mad at you too. And he's like, what on earth do you have to be mad at me for? And she's like, I don't know. Had to ring the bell. I don't know. Had to be nice to the witch. It's pretty good. So they end up back in London, and then all three of them end up back in London because she, of course, grabs hold for a ride again, and this witch goes crazy in London, which is where you're introduced. We're introduced to the cabbie.
I gotta say, I totally forgot about this part of the story. What a wild ride! I know, yeah. You have this like 7-foot giantess, like just storming through. Late 1800s London.
I love all of the interaction between the police officers, too, and, like, the store clerk. And she owes me a farthing.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff. And Andrew, even when he gets into, after Narnia is created, calls her, he loves her, but just talks about how much money she cost him in London and everything like that because she insisted on a meal. But I think the important part in London is where I think the reason you go to London, actually, is where you meet the cabbie who ends up being King Frank, who's the first king of Narnia. So as they emerge in Andrew's study. The witch, of course, goes crazy in the house. My other favorite character is the housemaid, who I forgot the exact wording, but had the most exciting day of her life that day because of all of the things she saw, like the witch going crazy and Aunt Nellie being flung across the room and the cabbie escapade outside. Uncle Andrew tries to take Jadis out to lunch, essentially. And we find out that went badly because as they're coming back, they're in like a horse-drawn carriage cab that's drawn by a nice horse called Strawberry. And a guy that's eventually become King Frank. And they're being followed by police, and they're just going.
I think it's funny crazy. Is that Diggory's aunt, sees Jadis in the house and thinks she's a prostitute. Yeah. Thinks his uncle's brought a prostitute to the house.
Because she can see her arms.
Yeah.
Naughty, naughty.
So this fight ensues in London, and Diggory essentially uses the ring to sort of sweep the whole escapade up with him into the wood between the world. And there's when you get the appearance of Aslan eventually.
They then go into one more puddle.
One more puddle, yeah.
The horse
The horse is there. The cabbie's there.
Well, the horse is actually who gets them to Narnia.
Yeah.
So the horse tries to go take a drink in a different puddle. Everybody's, by one chain of events, are not touching each other so that when Polly is touching her ring and they hit and the horse touches this puddle,
they all go into what will become Narnia.
It's, at the moment, completely empty, void world.
Yeah, it's nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then
things are sung into existence ex nihilo.
That's right.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And you see, I mean, eventually they see Aslan kind of off in the distance.
Walking, yeah.
And hear him. And one of the most beautiful pictures is that he's singing and slowly walking. And as he's doing this, like, things are erupting out of the ground, like, out of the earth. Did thou form me, you know, type stuff. And, I mean, I don't know how much farther you want to go. We did some of the other stuff with that, but basically Narnia gets sung into existence. Aslan pulls selected animals kind of off to the side after they're created, and he touches them with his nose and breathes on them, and they become talking beasts. They're actually charged with, I don't know if it's care more than not being unkind to the dumb beasts.
You must treat them kindly, I think.
Treat them kindly, yeah. They're not...
It's sort of like stewardship, you think?
Yeah,
like
they're not like
stewards
you.
Stewards of the...
Yeah, mm-hmm. But they must still be respected for what they are. I like that a lot because I don't like the sort of environmentalism that says, you know, don't eat the animals that God gave you for sustenance. But I do like respect them for what they are, you know. Yeah, I like that idea a lot. Yeah. I have a dog.
I mean, Aslan eventually even charges Frank with, you know, plowing and crops and building.
Oh, yeah. He asks him if he has an aptitude for it.
Yeah.
Is this the type of thing you could do? It's like, well, sir, I grew up in the country. We much liked that better than when we had to come to London. So, yeah. So he pulls him aside. He eventually will make the cabbie a king, first king of Narnia, King Frank. He brings his wife in, whose name is escaping me at the moment.
Helen.
Brings his wife in, and she becomes the first queen of Narnia. And then you get the sort of turn, which is what Caleb and I were talking about earlier, where Aslan starts mentioning all the good stuff and then goes, but of course, this world, this beautiful world is not 5 hours old, and yet there's evil in it. This world is not 7 hours old, and yet there's evil in it. And this is when Diggory starts to be really sort of convicted. Oh, by the way, the lamppost thing. While Jadis is in London, she grabs a sort of branch.
Crossbar or
something. Yeah, a crossbar off of a lamppost and is swinging it at cops and, like, whacking them with it.
Yeah.
And she's still holding it when she gets into the land that will become Narnia.
She throws it at Aslan.
And then she throws it at Aslan, and it hits him in the face and doesn't really do anything to him and bounces off and lands on the ground. She runs off into the mountains, and the part of the lamppost grows into a lamppost, which is the lamppost at Lantern Waste. And so if Lewis did write it to explain where the lamppost came from, that's where it came from.
And doesn't Andrew or Uncle Andrew then start thinking,
oh, yeah,
oh, I could bring all kinds of other things here.
Steamships and
parts from,
this. I could bring a cog and I'd have a battleship type thing.
I get this. Andrew's like a kind of like an alchemist.
Yeah.
Is the way I think of him.
You also get
the
sense.
He is an alchemist. That's right. Because when the witch meets him, she's like, you're no sorcerer. I can tell you don't come from royal blood. Only royalty breeds sorcerers.
Lewis also uses him as an example of somebody who has their heart hardened. So he can't hear the animals speak. When he's brought before Aslan, Diggory asks him to do something about his uncle, and Aslan says, "Your uncle cannot hear me.
Yeah.
He can't hear. He's closed his ears.
Yep.
So he cannot hear my voice. He's, you know, been hardened.
All he would hear would be growling.
Yeah.
Roaring. Sorry, mm-hmm. roaring.
So, which is also interesting. It really does bring in some of that act by the word.
Yeah. So then Aslan, as he acknowledges that evil's entered the world, he's like, we gotta do something about this, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of one of my favorite parts, because Aslan, I didn't write down the exact line, but Aslan says that because Diggory kind of caused this, Diggory's going to take the first step to protect Narnia. And essentially what happens is Strawberry, the horse, gets named as Fledge and becomes a talking horse. And then Aslan makes him the first flying horse. And as far as we know in Narnia, the only referred to flying horse. In fact, in Magician's Nephew, in The Last Battle, when Fledge shows up again, everyone's like, is that a flying horse? You know, and so
you kind of do also get the sense that Los regretted not thinking of having flying horses earlier, because he calls Fledge the first of the race of flying horses. Yeah. And you're like, Los is like, oh man, I really missed out. I could have had Pegasus this whole time.
Missed out on Pegasus this whole time. But they basically send Diggory up to the high mountain, where he is kind of challenged again to sort of follow the word, the rules that Aslan gave him for doing this. And essentially what he goes into this sort of fortress kind of, enters by the gate, gets the apple that he's supposed to get to go plant down in Narnia. The witch comes over, right, over the wall, which she's not mm-hmm. supposed to, which doesn't work out for her. That really kind of limits her for, seems like, several hundred years. He goes back down. They plant the tree. This apple tree then is supposed to protect Narnia from this evil for a period of time. But Aslan acknowledges, and I wish I'd have written down the exact wording, acknowledges that there will be a future time when he will actually have to pay the price for what Diggory did.
Yeah, he says this man will be part of the solution to this great evil introduced.
Other men will be part of the solution too.
But then he says the greatest of the evil is going to fall on me.
The greatest price I think I will pay, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I liked that, because when we did Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, however many weeks ago, we talked about the fact that in the Alistair McGrath pod, they kind of were struggling with, did the atonement in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe do anything except for Edmund, or to Edmund? And I think this answers that. I think the atonement paid in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan here in The Magician's Nephew says, is going to pay for it all. Like, it's going to pay for Diggory's sin, by ringing the bell and bringing Jadis into mm-hmm. this world. It's going to pay for all the evil that she does in this meantime, that the tree is kind of like providence, or like, sort of, we might even say, like, first use of the law stuff.
Just keeping her at bay.
Yeah, it's just, there's a restraint happening here, that things aren't getting as evil as they could be if this tree weren't around. Mm-hmm. It obviously doesn't stop all evil, right? But it's pushing back on it. But that he will pay the final price. He will be the one to pay the final price. Man will be involved again, like mm-hmm. that, but in making amends for this. So I think that answers that question pretty firmly. Mm-hmm. So anyway, as the story wraps up, Diggory's still worried about his mom. He asks Aslan, is there any way I could take one of these apples back? Would it heal my mom? He says something great. It's kind of like the resurrection of Lazarus, right? That Aslan says, yeah, you can take an apple back. Have your mom eat it. She won't be sick anymore, but she's still going to die someday. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going to do what it would do for her here.
Lazarus' resurrection isn't the same as the resurrection from the dead.
Right.
Which is why
Lazarus died again.
Yeah, which is also why it's not an example of, like, you know, quote, the first fruits of our resurrection. That's only Christ's.
Yeah.
Who won't die again. Yeah.
So I really appreciate
something called a recitation, or...
Yes. Resuscitation?
Resuscitation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this... Not, yeah. And this happens for his mom. The interesting thing is, at the end of the book, sort of as like a appendices, you find out that...
I knew the second he was planting that apple tree that it... Yeah.
They plant this apple, and this apple mm-hmm. grows into a big tree. Now, I've seen apple trees. So I can't imagine making a wardrobe out of a single apple tree. But this has got to be...
Oh, he says, no, one plank. in the end of the book. Right. Yeah, it says one, you know, one plank was driven to make a part of the wardrobe.
Okay, so a part of the wardrobe is made out of this apple tree.
Let's assume the back plank, right? Yeah.
And this becomes the wardrobe and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because eventually Diggory's dad comes back from England, some other uncle dies, and Diggory's parents inherit the house that Professor Kirk is living in when the children come to stay with him during the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is where the wardrobe is. It's made from the apple tree that would blow on days when it wasn't stormy on Earth, but was obviously storming in Narnia.
Very cool.
Very cool. I like this one a little bit.
I like this one, too. In fact, my personal ranking changed after rereading this. This is probably my second favorite.
What behind, I assume, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Yeah, I think
because you really like the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, right?
I do. Yeah, I think
this displaced it, huh?
I think this did displace it. I really did like that when I realized that the book was more of a long narrative of the introduction of evil, I actually liked the way that that took place, especially seeing, you know, the race of Charn is sort of angels. And that their world was destroyed by a great power struggle, and the last fallen angel sort of is introduced to this next world kind of thing. It's all speculative.
Michael Ward does a lot with that.
Yeah, it's all speculative, but there's pieces, bits, right? Like, you know, angels occupy, in a sense, a different realm. We don't see them. We don't interact with them all the time. Fallen angel is indeed a great problem here. It's one of the promises of Christ is to destroy, you know, that fallen angel. And so you do get that sense. And I just liked it from that perspective. So I think it's good. And I like that it's a different world. It's a different realm Narnia is. So it doesn't have to be the same sort of 7-day creation or 6-day creation with rest that that ours is. Not everything's a one for one, but the idea of a word bringing in creation and then evil coming in from another being it's good. It's a good book.
Yeah, I liked it. Again. Yeah. I said last week, though, that it's one of my
favorites.
Yeah, I think it's been my number two for a while. I'm really a big fan of, more so than most, I think, of Silver Chair.
That's actually my number three or four. So I think it's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Magician's Nephew, probably Voyage of the Dawn Treader for me, and then Silver Chair. And those would all be really close. I think after that, I could probably take or leave everything.
I like Horse and His Boy quite a bit.
Yeah.
So. But just for the themes and how not every sort of... if we are calling this even Horson's Boy a Christian tale, not every Christian tale has to be a one-to-one adventure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, I think this is about wraps us up here, unless you got something, Adam, real quick.
I don't have anything. We're past time. So.
Cool. Well, we will catch you next week. If you are joining us for the first time, the rest of the episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. We started with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and so you can go check that out. You can also go to the 1517 website, 1517.org, to see all of the Thinking Fellows episodes and every other project produced by 1517. We will catch you next week. Bye.